Okay, we are here for our next session, and we are back on time. We'll let Brad take us a little over time, I guess, now. So, Brad, the stage is all yours, and thank you.
All right, great. Thank you. So, like I said, I'm Brad Abrams. I'm the Product Unit Manager here at Microsoft, and it's my pleasure to come and talk about a little bit about Silverlight for building business apps and RIA services in particular. So how many people have played with RIA services at all? Okay, good. A fair number of you. So there'll be a few gems for you, but for the rest of you that raised your hand and the 1,000-some people watching the stream right now, it's largely an introduction, but I definitely did put a few gems, and I think you'll learn a couple of things. So what we're going to do is I wanted to kind of do the no slides thing and just take you through from scratch building up an app with Silverlight 3 and the current .NET RIA services bits. And as we walk through there, I'll hopefully put things in context and explain how things are going. But if you guys that are here, if you want to just jump in with questions, feel free. And folks online, please use Twitter. Go ahead and ask questions there, and we'll have people reading that and shouting them out for you. Okay, so let's get started. So to go build a Silverlight app, actually, before I get started, I did want to break it down a little bit. What I really mean by a business application? Well, the first thing we're going to talk about is how to have a professional feel. So with business apps, it's not about eye candy, really, but it is about the work that you've done and make sure that it looks really nice and it feels really nice and users have a great user experience. So we're going to talk about how to do that. And we're going to specifically look at how to do that from a developer perspective. You saw some expression demos earlier. We're going to look at how developers with sort of medium to low UX design skills, that's me, can go about writing those apps. And then we're going to spend a lot of time on data. We're going to talk about rich data query. How do you get data into these Silverlight applications? How do you do validation and data update? How do you do authentication? And then we're going to spend if there's time, a little bit of time on different views of that. So that'll be more clear later. Okay, so we'll refer back to this to help keep me on track. So what I've done is I've just said file new project. This is VS 2008 with Silverlight 3 installed and .NET RIA services, the July bits. So you can see you have a couple of options. I have a couple of favorites in here, which we'll talk about. One is the Silverlight navigation application, and that is the kind of base level, what I think of an application pattern that we'll look at. And then there's another one that you get that we'll spend the most time in, and that's a Silverlight business application, and we added that as part of .NET RIA services, and we'll show you that in a minute. So I've pre-created this app, so let's go ahead and at least I've gone ahead and hit F5 for you. But this is basically the default template that comes. I just want to give you a sense for what's there. So you can see this is a very basic app. It's a full-frame Silverlight app. So the whole thing is Silverlight. There's no web in here. My previous job before I took over this team, I was GPM for ASP.NET, so I come from kind of a very web background. So one of the things we wanted to do with this piece of technology was make Silverlight very web-friendly, make it feel like a web platform. So one of the most interesting things about the web is links, the notion of navigation and links, and so that's what we've done here. I have a couple of pages here that I can navigate between. I don't know if you can see the content here is very basic, but it's changing. And also what's interesting here is you notice the URL up here is changing as I go through there. So as I pop through here, and what's cool about that is I can take this and there's a notion of a deep link. So I can grab that and open up another browser and go ahead and paste that in, and it brings me back to this app in the same state. So I have a deep link there. Yes, so I'll get into it a little bit. So what he's asking is this about what is significant about that. So the very last project I did on ASP.NET was ASP MVC, and we have a routing system within ASP MVC where you can say, here's the URL space I want to use. The URL name is about, and that goes to this physical this physical view. And so we've essentially used the exact same system here. So this is a name that you define, and then you point, I'll show you in a minute where you do, you point at an actual XAML page to display when that's used. No, this is using the Silverlight navigation template, and I'll show you that in just a sec. Okay, so you can do that, and then the other thing is for web apps, the browser is our kind of primary place people view those, and the browser has a pretty strong application model. For example, you can navigate. Oops, let's do it here. You can navigate forwards and back in a browser, and notice that's changing. So forwards and back is built into Silverlight with its navigation application, and you can see the history here. I can navigate between here using the history. And what's really cool about that is I can open this up in a different browser. So I can send an email link to somebody else who maybe uses a different browser. I can't imagine anybody who would use any other browser, but there is others available. And so you can do that and notice that if I send that link, the Silverlight application loads up in other browsers. The navigation continues to work as I navigate between here. And guess what? Forward and back work in the other browsers as well. So deeply integrated into the browser world. So the other thing, as anybody's noticed, I'll talk in more depth about it, but there's a little login button here. That little login piece, that is the thing that the business application template adds. It adds that login. So one little thing you wouldn't think. But anyway, it's very cool. It brings up a login dialog. If I don't have an account registered, which I don't, I can go ahead and register one. So I don't think I have that one registered. And notice if I actually make a mistake here, it actually gives you some nice data validation. And where you saw a little bit, Tim showed you a little bit about how that works. I'm going to show you in more depth about that. And then the answer, we all know that's 42. So now if I say register there, what it's going to do is it uses the ASP.NET application level services that are available, and it created a new user for me in the ASP.NET since and used and in this case, it used the ASP.NET database for that. But you can configure that in any way you want to. That's been around since ASP.NET 2.0, and it's kind of widely popular. Has everybody used that membership system in ASP.NET? Okay, good. A few of you have, so you know what I'm talking about. So now what we've done is extensions to that so that it's usable within Silverlight. So now Silverlight has a first-class notion of who a user is, and it allows you to log in and log out for that user. And we're going to talk, that's going to be really important when we talk about doing the data access in a minute, because a lot of times that's authenticated. Okay, so now let's take a minute and think, that's what you get out of, you get all that with file new. Let's look at how we go and customize that. The first thing you get is if you look at the application structure here, Tim talked a little bit about this, but I want to spend a minute on it. I think every meaningful RIA application has some interesting parts to it on the server and the client. I don't think we're in a world with RIA applications where you can write purely client-side code. There are definitely developers with that bent and try to use the server just as like a data tier. I don't think that's the right approach for RIA applications. I think what you want to do is model a lot of your business logic on the server where it's very secure, where it can be very close to the data. And then kind of do the UI logic on the Silverlight tier. So what we're in is a world where there's significant code on the server and the client. The advantage of, I think that's true of any RIA development, and I think my buddies at other companies would agree with that assessment, but the advantage of being at Microsoft, the advantage of being a .NET developer today, is that we have a great development environment to let you do .NET development on the server and the client in a very seamless way, and I hope that'll come out today. So you can use C# on the server and the client, you can use basically the same framework on the server and the client, you can leverage some of the exact same code on the server and the client. So that's the basic model that we have. And then these two projects, because I selected to enable .NET RIA services when I created this app, there's an implicit link between these projects from the server to the client and from the client to the server so that they implicitly know about each other. So when I change the server or change the client, the analogous changes are made. So these are very integral. Okay, now let's look at how we do some customizations. So the first thing, let's spend time on the client for a little while. The first thing is we have a main page, and that's that root frame that we saw. And then we have several views. We have a home and about views, and we'll look at those in a little bit. So what's really interesting about following a pattern like this is once you're following an application pattern, there's a lot of benefits we can provide. So for example, Karina, our UX designer, has gone and created that very attractive default theme we saw, which we think a lot of apps will use. But then because all the applications follow the same pattern, she also created about 10 other application themes that literally all you have to do is grab a styles XAML file and drop it in your directory, and immediately your app starts to look different. It starts to kind of look like another look. So, given that she has 20 or so, my guess is you can find something that's kind of to your liking and kind of fits. This one, I think, is a particular good business example that fits kind of what you're trying to do. So I won't bore you with how to do that, but I did want to show you a little bit about how you can do some customization. So I can open up this main XAML page, and we'll look at some of this in a little more detail. Yeah, so this app now, there's a set of styles, and there's one that's the name of the application. We're going to write a placement service for super employees. We have a bunch of superheroes that in this economy are out of work, and we need to help them find jobs. So it's a super employees placement service. So we can change the title there. Another thing we can go do is go customize that style. So all those styles that I showed you on Karina's blog there, they're just specializations of this styles.xaml. So all you have to do is pop that open and blend, and you can have a great time with it. Or if you're kind of more of a novice and you just kind of want to mess with it a little bit, we've pulled these properties up to the top. Like my favorite is the navigation background brush. And you can see Karina painstakingly chose this particular color that exactly matches her vision. I'm going to be a little more random about it. Oh, yeah, dark golden. This is a beautiful color. We want it to be that color. So that's another level of customization you can do. So let's go ahead and hit F5, and you can see my beautiful UX design at work. So there we go. So that's very pretty. And then you can see it picked up the title, so that was very easy to do. Another thing I wanted to show you, I missed when we were doing navigation, is if you navigate to a page that doesn't exist, how is that handled? And so we catch that on the client, and so you get kind of a semi-okay error message. And in fact, any error that bubbles up on the client, there's a top-level exception handler that rather than your app crashing, it brings up essentially this sort of 404 screen, if you will, in a web sense. So it gives you a place to do that. So I can also go in and customize this because this is just that error window. So does Silverlight JavaScript have any of this? What is Silverlight JavaScript? Oh, no, I'll talk about this. Silverlight.js just handles activating the actual Silverlight control. It handles doing the various div tags or whatever that the different browsers need to get Silverlight up and running, but it doesn't do these errors. So I can go in and customize this error screen. So for example, this is the text that says an unknown error has occurred. I don't really like that. That kind of leaves users hanging. So what I can do is customize this. And we can just have people call our support engineer anytime, day or night. Let's see, at 4. Wait, that's not Israeli's number. It's fine. Okay, so we can go and customize that. Hopefully, we won't see that error message much in this demo because it usually means I made a mistake. But there you go. You can go and customize the error message. And then the last thing, this is something you were talking about, is how do we go and add a new page, and how does the navigation framework work there? So it's actually very easy to do. The convention is to put it in the views folder. You don't have to follow the convention, and I think you'll see how to get out of it. But if we create a new page, and we just select the Silverlight page, call it page one, it puts this page in here. And we can open it up, and this is kind of our page. You can see it's very nice. And then what we can do is go into main, and now we need to wire it up into the navigation framework. So you can see the style that we've used is we've used this stack panel of hyperlink buttons. So we just go through and add one more, and with my font so large, it's kind of crazy. But we call it link 3 here, and then we could call it whatever we want here. So this is the URL namespace we were talking about. So we'll call it page 2, even though it's page 1, just to show you we can do that. And then, oops, sorry. This is where we do that. And this actually has to be what it is. So yeah, so this is the content, and that's page 2. And then this is the actual navigation URI. And then I think I have to change the name of this too. Okay, so now if I hit F5, that should work. What we see, there we go. So now you see page 2 is available. And we can click through here and go to page 2 as well. I notice the URL says page 1. So you can actually go in and modify what exactly that namespace looks like there as well. So that's the basics of wiring up a page. What somebody usually asks at this point is, what if I have a page that's not built into this Zap? So I can I dynamically download a page? And I have a couple of blog posts with some techniques on how to do that. But yeah, you can put a page in another Zap and have it dynamically downloaded only when the user clicks on it. In this case, these are all built into the same Zap. Okay, so that's the basics of kind of a good look and feel. So that's the client. Let's twist a little bit and go back up to the server and talk data for a while. I think this part of it should feel pretty familiar to ASP.NET developers. What I'm going to do is I have a database that you might be familiar with called Northwind. Just for the simplicity of the demo, I'm going to copy it into the app data directory. But you can obviously use SQL Server or Oracle or whatever you'd like. So I just want to pop it open so you can see what's here. See, it's just a set of tables, and I've added a table called Super Employees, and those are the fields on it. So we're going to have an app that kind of works against that table. So to do that, one of the things, I'm really a .NET developer. I don't do great with T-SQL and kind of the database goo. So what I would like to do is take that database and create a objective view of it, or a .NET view of that database. So there's a set of technologies called object relational mappers, there's a couple of choices out there. In Hibernate is a very popular one. Linked to SQL is popular, I'm going to show you Entity Framework, just kind of to show you one of the ones Microsoft has. But again, everything I'm going to show you will work with really any ORM that you happen to want to use. Okay. So what I'm going to do, go to data and find entity data model, and then I'm just going to call this Northwind. And we'll do it from a database. So how many people are using Entity Framework today? Framework, okay, a handful. What ORMs are other people using? Just yell them out. Link to SQL, okay, a handful, yeah. So everything I'm showing works with Link to SQL in almost exactly the same way. So we'll select. Okay, so now we have our super employees. And then for you Link to SQL people, I'll go ahead and make that not plural so you can feel right at home. So that's the name of the entity, is this super employee entity. And then I can go ahead and on the properties, I can change this. So the entity name to super employees. That way we'll all feel comfortable. So this is essentially a .NET view of that type. So again, all this is happening on the server. So you have the full power of .NET on the server. So now what I want to do is think about, how am I going to get this data to the client, and how am I going to work with the data? Very rarely is what I want to do just take exactly the data out of the database and send it to the client. Usually, I have to do some operations on it to prepare it for the client. I have to maybe mash it up with some other data. I have to maybe change the way it looks slightly, ignore some fields, add some fields. I have to filter it in some way. So there's usually some business logic associated with it. So what we're going to do is show you how to go do that. So now this is where we enter into the .NET Rea Services part of things. Oh, right. Yeah, and before I do that, I have this beautiful picture to show you. I got started doing with the no slides thing, and then I was like, oh, man, I need this picture. What am I going to do? So I decided to draw it, and you see I should be an artist. Isn't this picture the way most people, not you, but most other people write applications? Don't they just take UI and bind it directly to data? If I think about my ASP.NET experience, I saw a lot of customers do that. And in fact, I saw a lot of demos Microsoft gave do that, have UI that connects directly to a database. And that's not wholly bad. It's a very productive way to go. But maintenance of this kind of application becomes a problem, right? And then if I think about our client developers, people who came from WinForms or whatnot, or VB6, a lot of them do this as well, right? Line of sight directly to the database. Now, as we move into an in-tier development world, as we move into a Rea world, this pattern, this is our opportunity, I think, as an industry to move past this pattern and to move to a more maintainable, a more performant, scalable kind of system. So that's what we're suggesting. So basically, I have this other picture. It is, how can I have a database that goes to a set of application logic on the mid-tier, and then the UI is driven off that application logic? And what's great about this picture is once you've done this, there's definitely a point there where you can do scaling, a point there where you can do access control, you can do filtering and whatnot. But what else is neat is that sometimes our data needs change over time. I was just talking to a group at Microsoft IT, our internal IT team, and they're building an on-premises solution today, a solution where they own the database. But they know they need to move that solution to Azure in the future, to Windows Azure, to the cloud. So they're taking advantage of Rea services because they know that while part of their application logic might need to change when they move that, none of their client UI will have to change. You can seamlessly move from targeting an on-premise SQL Server database to Azure or to EC2 or to any other system. So this gives you kind of a level of indirection there. And I have one more picture I'll show you towards the end. Okay, so anyway, we're going to talk about just a simple one here. Oh, right, so this isn't what we're doing. We're doing a domain service. So let's do super employees. So we're going to create a new super employees type, and then we get this nice little wizard that comes up. We only have this one entity. We're enable editing and enable this generation of metadata. And notice there could be other data context or object context, whatever ORM you're using would work fine. And we'll say okay, and we'll generate that. And if you take a look at what gets generated here, this is kind of our middle tier logic class. So it's a super employees domain service, and think about it as a specialization of a special kind of WCF service. That's the way you should kind of mentally think about this. And it's one that knows about our Northwind entities that we've just created. Again, you don't have to use Entity Framework. You can use any ORM or none if you'd like, and it would work the same sort of way. But then we've done a couple of things, and we'll walk through these in a little bit of detail later. But we have this get super employees method that actually returns context.super employees. And now here's where you can go write some business logic. So I'll do some very basic ones. What do I want to say? Issues is greater than 100. I hope that doesn't mess me up. And then I can say, oh, and I want this thing ordered by, imp.name. So I can use the power of link, and I can create kind of some business logic in here. Obviously, I can make that arbitrarily complex. And then notice what I'm returning here is an iQueryable. We'll talk about the significance of that in a minute, but we're turning iQueryable is sort of our delayed execution model. We're returning to the client a pointer to a query so that I can go execute that. So we're not going to snap all the data in the database. And then the other thing we have here is an insert method, an update method, a delete method for a super employee. So essentially, we've handled query and create, update, and delete. So That pattern, I think, is what a lot of web apps are doing, right? They're basically querying data, they're creating data, updating and deleting data. So this is kind of the pattern that we've baked in and encapsulated. So now what I'll do is go ahead and build that. And so now we're sort of done with the server. We built out this service. Is there a question? We've built out this service, and now what we want to do is go see about how we can go consume that on the client with kind of minimum plumbing out of here. So let's go into home, and let's put, I have to use my code snippets now. Let's go drop a data grid. We saw earlier the presentation with all the cool UI controls in the toolkit. I'm going to be a little bit basic, but I think you'll get the idea. So I'll take these out and just put a data grid. So just a very simple data grid. And then I'll go into code behind here, and I will customize that data grid. So the first thing I want you to notice is we have a new namespace that's available to us, myapp.web. So web is the namespace from the server. It's the server namespace. So we've created a client proxy to talk to that, and that's in system.web. And what's in that client proxy super employees domain context. Whoops. Yes. What tells Visual Studio to create the proxy? There's two pieces to it. One is you need to have this enable client access on there. That tells it to create the proxy. And then you have to be in a solution that has the .NET RIA services link enabled. So if you have the link enabled and any class with enable any domain service with enable client access on, it will get a proxy created. So we think that that's a little bit of a simpler model than the add service reference thing and having to keep them updated. You'll see as I go through here, I can update this service without having to regen or rebuild everything. And in fact, in Dev 10, we have live IntelliSense. So as soon as I change it here, I get IntelliSense on it on the client without even building. So they're really two sides of the same application. So we create a new data context. And then I need to do data grid, item source, gets context dot. And then I have a super employees property on that context. What told us to have that super employees context is because you had the query method. We saw the query method the wizard generated that returned an iQueryable of super employees. So if you have a method that's an iQueryable of super employees, you get this super employees method property here. Yes, the way you pass parameters in your service, in the query, it's fine. You just put, int page. Do what? You do that. And then on the client, in the client, what you do is on context.load, there's an overload that lets you take that parameter. So we'll do, let's see, what is it? So what we're going to do is just pass this query. Maybe it's here. Anyway, we'll pass the query. And what that is it's kind of the root of a link query. I could do link queries here on the client against that query. For now, I'll just have it be blank. But we'll pass that query up to the server. So let me go ahead and undo this so it works. So essentially what we've done is we've created a context, and we've data bind it, and then we call load. So while we're trying to make the interior world simple, the fact is this isn't transparent remoting. If anybody remembers that back in the days where we pretended network boundaries didn't exist. Network boundaries do exist, and you do have to know about them, but we can take the plumbing out of dealing with them. So hopefully that's what we've done. Let's see if this actually works. And there, I still have my beautiful colors. And there you go. So I get a bunch of data back. from the server. So that was a very kind of seamless experience for doing that. If you think about what happened here, when the Silverlight app loaded, it loaded that data grid control, which went and accessed the context. When the context said load, we did an asynchronous call to the server, and then when the data came back, we populated it through the magic of data binding. Does that make sense? Yeah. Yeah, there is. We've been working very hard on that upgrade path over the last couple of weeks. And so I don't have it on the bits today. But basically, the model you should think about is the server, this domain service guy, what you can do is now have a new base class for whatever your service op is called domain service. And all your existing service ops will keep working exactly the way they do today. And then you can go and add this iQueryable one or these CUD, these create, update, and delete methods to it. Does that make sense?
You don't have to use iQueryable to get. What I'm really looking for is the removing the service references and the constant.
Yeah, so you don't have to use iQueryable or any of the other stuff. If you want just to get rid of the service references, that would work. We think that eventually you'll find value in the query and whatnot as well, but you don't have to use it. Yeah, sure. No, I get that. Okay, so where was I? Oh, right. So that's basic. That just sucked all the data out of my database and returned it. If you have a toy database like mine, that's fine. But if you have a real database, you don't want to return all the data out of the database to the client, right? That doesn't make any sense. What you want to do is do paging. So let me show you an example of how to build a link query here on the client for this thing. So the first thing I'm going to do is also show you how to do this declaratively. So I'm going to remove this code for just right now. And I'm going to flip over and spend a little bit more time in the XAML here. Let me grab a snippet of code. Yep. The question was, will it be on-demand paging? And it will. Okay, so let me explain what I just put in here that hopefully will work for us. Oh, yeah. Okay, so basically we have a new control in Silverlight called a domain data source control. So this control essentially knows about that domain context we just created, and it knows how to form link queries to do things like paging, filtering, sorting that goes against that. And what we've done is we've said, look, my query name is get super employees, so that should be the same name as this iQueryable method here, get super employee. Yeah, it is good. And then what we've said is set the load size to 20. So what we've said is load data in chunks of 20 at a time. So pull down the first 20, and then if you need to get more, go back and get more. That ensures your application stays responsive. If instead you said pull down all, that might take a while. So you can set it to chunk the data. And then this line isn't working. Let's see here if I can make it work. Yeah, so now I'm saying what is the domain context to go use. That's the super employee's domain context. And notice it's a one-to-one map with the domain service class there. Okay, and then what I've done is I've taken my data grid and I've set the item source here. I've bound it to that DDS, that's that control we just created. And I've bound it to the data property on that control. So as data comes in, that's what it'll be. And then I put another control on here called a data pager. And I've bound it to that same DDS.data, and I've set its page size to be 10. And that's a visual. This is a visual control. It's display 10 at a time and then give me forward and back buttons. And then I wrap the whole thing in a very cool control that David Pohl wrote called activity control. And I've bound it to, the isBusy property. So DDS has an isBusy. That means, look, I'm actively going and getting the data. So display some UI to indicate that something's happening. So if we run this time what we'll do, pull down the data. So now we have our data grid. And now I can page through it. So I'm displaying 10 records. right? And remember, we downloaded in chunks of 20. So I'm displaying 10. So if I hit next here, it displays the next. If I hit next, it has to go back to the server. I guess it's my server's so fast. Let me go and slow things down a little. I highly recommend you doing this. You know, people know what I'm doing here. Sleep. Well, what should I do? 2,000, that seem right? So what? That should be 2 seconds, I think. So now we bring it up. Okay, so there's our delay. So if you have a real, that's what you'll see. And then I downloaded 20, displayed 10, display the next 10. Now when I go back to the server, I have to go back and do it again. So that's paging. Let me show you sorting, and then I'll explain more. So now I can go and I can sort these by employee ID, I think. Yeah, so I can sort it by employee ID. And notice it's not sorting the ones locally. It's taking that sort and sending it to the server and sorting them there and then bringing it back.
Is it the same concept of the
grid control? Yeah, this is basically the data grid. It's very similar to ASP's grid view. So let's think about what just happened here. I basically showed you paging and sorting. And what's happening is I'm building up this link query on the client. I'm serializing it and sending it to the server. And then that link query is being, I think the term is composed with the query that you return from this get super employees method. So we're applying that link query over top of this. And because this link query is an entity framework link query, the way entity framework works and link to SQL is it takes a link query and it turns it into T-SQL and executes that directly on the database. So essentially what we've just done is via user gestures on the Silverlight client, we've created optimized T-SQL and executed that on the server and then returned the results all the way back. Yeah?
When you get to the second page of data and you
Yeah, that's a good question. So he asks, you know, what do you, you know, when you go to the second page, I'll make your question even worse. So if you go to the second page of data and does it, and go back, where is my app? So if you go here, and then go back, does it still have the data? So today, the implementation of domain data source today, we've tried to keep it fairly simple, so we throw it away. So when we go and get the next page of data, we throw away the previous data. We have a lot of prototypes and whatnot for keeping up with that data. It's certainly a rich area in the community as well where people are playing around with different algorithms for how to keep that data or not. In read-only scenarios, you can do amazing things with caching the data. As soon as you enable editing, which is where we're going next, the data caching thing just gets it gets really tough. But there's nothing with our model that wouldn't work with that. In fact, we have a demo of this exact same app working offline, so you can store all this in isolated storage and persist it over several runs of the app.
Can you say cache duration for a small window?
Cache duration, yes. So now you're talking about server caching, right? So we do support server caching. I don't remember the exact syntax today, but you can on that query method say cache this result in the ASP.NET. Cache for this length of time. So if you have 100 clients hitting it, only the first client will have to return that data. So that does work. Okay, another thing to show, just to recall the page navigation stuff we talked about earlier. Notice as I navigate between pages, the default model for navigation is that it tears down the page when you go away and recreates it when you come back. So if you notice, when I go away, that data grid is gone, and when I come back, it has to recreate. When I come back, it has to recreate the data grid and reload the data. We think that's the right default model. WPF had a different default model, and that has caused some problems. So we think this is the right default. But sometimes you might want to have a more stateful model on the client, and you, as app developer, might decide to take care of the data. So what you can do is, if I remember the exact syntax here. There's a property on page, so this base class is page. So I can do navigation cache mode, and I can say enabled. So now I can say I want to enable caching of this page. So now what will happen is when I navigate away from the page, we'll keep it alive in memory. And I can't remember exactly the defaults. I don't know if anybody from Silverlight remembers. I think it's we keep 5 pages or something. So if you have this, we keep 5 by default. And then we'll start aging them out of the cache. That's completely controllable. But the way it works is now if I go to about and back to home, notice you didn't see that delay where I went to the server because this page is still live. Does that make sense? Okay, so that's that. No, that's an in-memory cache. The one I just showed you is an in-memory. So if you close the browser, it's gone. So the other cache we talked about is kind of a prototype that somebody has done on top of RIA services. It does use isolated storage for that. Okay, what's next? Okay, so read-only scenarios, as I say, are easy. Let's think about read-write scenarios. So the way I think about that is let's do validating data update. So we're going to update this data, but do it in a way that's kind of validation aware. So let's see. What do I need to do to do that? I'm going to grab another couple of snippets. Oh, I missed this. You got to see this. Like the team works so hard on this. I have to demo it. So basically what you can do within here is support grouping. So I'll go ahead and show you that real quick. So yeah, another couple of things on read-only is grouping. And this is mainly a data grid feature, but I think it's a cool one. It's the first time any data grid at Microsoft has supported grouping. So I have to demo that. So that's kind of nice. So now we have groups. And what I've done is I've just said to group by publisher, and we figured all that out. So that's kind of cool. And what's neat is I was able to say that, if you notice, I did that on the domain data source. So anybody binding to that data source will get the grouped data if you have a control that supports grouping. So that's one thing that's cool. Another thing that I totally glossed over is filtering. A lot of times you want to support searching or filtering over the data. Don't you love snippets? Don't you wish your code came with snippets like that? So I'm just going to put a little text box here for the origin filter. So it's just a label and a text box. And then what I'm going to want to do, so basically what I want to do is somebody types an origin in there, like where these superheroes are from, Earth, Venus, wherever. I want to show only those from that planet. So what I do is I want to add a filter descriptor here to domain data source. And I'll break that apart for you so you can see it. So we just paste that guy in. And the way this one works is you just say, what you do is you wire up the UI control with the data model. So what I'm saying is the UI control is the origin filter text box and the text property on that guy, and bind it with the origins property using the operator starts with. So if origin.starts with origin filter box.text, then display it. Does that make sense? So. So this is similar to like. I don't know, does like do this is like string dot starts with. So now if we run that, and again, remember what's happening is we're not executing any of that on the client. We're going to take this fun stuff and put. Why did the UI not work right? Anyway, I have a UI bug. We're going to take and actually put that up on the server. So when I say Earth, then what it's going to do is it takes that data, sends it up to the server, and executes that there, and then gets the results back. So, again, it's more of that sort of thing. Okay. Any questions on that? Yeah. Yes. What are you? You're picking on my demo. Okay. I think I'm going to address it. I think I'm going to address it right now. So here's what I'm going to do. That just having text there kind of sucks. What I want to do is I would create my own custom entity that includes the name, the origin, as well as the count, like how many employees are from that. Create an own custom type with an int and a string that's a little better than just a string, but it's my own custom entity, and then I'm going to return that. And so let me show you that, and we'll see if it helps a little bit. So what I want to do is I'll come down here. Let's see. I'm going to steal the code in the interest of time. Yep, so there it is. So this is my origin class. You see all it has is name and count. Now the rules are if it's a query method, if it turns out queryable, it has to have something that's a key. We have to have something to key off of. And we need to be able to create you, so you have to have a default constructor. So those are the rules for that. And then I'm going to write a simple query method that goes and returns that. So if anybody knows Ayande in Hibernate guy, he helped me kind of port this demo that we're doing to in Hibernate, and he looked at this code and laughed at me a little bit. So if you're going to do this on in Hibernate, you should improve this code. But basically what it does is it's a link query that links that gets all the super employees, gets the origins out of them, and then once it has the origin, it counts the number of employees that have that same origin, and then it trims out any duplicates that we have. So it's a fairly inefficient piece of code to go write. But what I think it shows is how I can go create my own custom entity that's based on data, that's based on joining data. So this happens to be joining data from the same table, but I could be pulling data from several tables, and I put them in my own custom class that I'm shaping. Does that address it at all, or a little bit? Okay. So let's look at what I want to do on the client with that. So I love the control toolkit stuff we just saw. So rather than this lame text box, I mean, if you have the control toolkit, why would you use a text box when you could use an autocomplete extender? I actually didn't see him demo this. Did he demo the autocomplete? I don't think he did. Okay, so we want the autocomplete guy, and then we want to show populating that. So there's the autocomplete, and what we're saying is bind its name to this, and then I have an item template already set up in the resources. And then what we want to do is go into code behind here. And I could create another domain data source, but I just wanted to show it in code. So here what we're doing, why doesn't it like that? There we go. Awesome. Why doesn't it like that? Hold on. I don't think I built. Okay, build succeeded. Oh, look at that. That's lovely. Okay. Yes. Okay, so what we've done here is I've taken that origin filter and I've said it's going to be content.origins, and then I'm doing that same load that we saw before. So now when I hit F5, what we should see at least a little bit of is that autocomplete extender. And now on page load, it's actually populated this autocomplete extender. So now when I type E, I get Earth back. Wasn't super exciting. What do I have more than one of? No. Human. Yeah, there we go. So there you go. So I have human one and human two. So I can go complete from there. So that's an example of at least a little bit more complex querying. Okay. So I think now we're ready to go. That's ready to go to read-write. So in the interest of time here, I'm just going to paste a little bit of code in here for that. Let me just grab it real quick. Yeah, we already did that one. Okay, so basically this code, it's just a little bit of code. It's not as much as it looks. Basically, I'm just going to replace the data grid and have it be the master, and then add a details view as well. So let's run it first. Hopefully that giant paste worked. And then I think you'll get a sense for what's going on. So I have a data grid, and I have a details view. Okay, there you go. So the data grid, I've just shrunk it. Before I was auto-generating the columns. Now I've said just these three columns. And so as I kind of jump through here, notice the data is changing over here. So a couple of things just to play around with it to notice. One is that I can change the data here And notice it, as soon as I do that, it changes it. I guess you can't see that when I point at my screen. It changes the data here. So notice it's Diana Troy 2 now. And then notice that I can hit cancel here, and that goes away. So it's not a UI trick we're doing. The actual entities we're creating support cancelability, and that's pretty neat for kind of nice UI. I'll show you in a minute. I'm not right now, but I will. That's part of validating is I'm going to make that read only. No, when I do cancel, it restores back to this person's view of truth, so the local client's view of truth. So what else can I do? So I wanted to show editing. So I can change this guy. Notice I get this dirty indicator here. So all of our entities know if they're dirty or not. So we're doing change tracking on the client. So is this entity knows he's dirty, and so this data form control is picking up on that and saying this guy's dirty. And then I can go and change Batman 2, and notice he's dirty. So now I have two that are dirty, and these that and others that are not. So some are dirty, some are not.
So how do you code coding isolation mode?
How am I coding isolation mode?
Dirty or clean?
You mean or? Yeah, so you'll see in a second, we're keeping up with exactly why it's dirty. We know exactly which property and why, and you'll see that in just a sec. Okay, so that's that. Now what we want to do is once we have guys that are dirty, we want to kind of batch the updates and send them up to the server. So I've had a couple that are dirty, and now I want to send those back to the server. So let's just write a couple of lines of code to do that. Right. So what I have to do, I have that submit button, but it's not wired up. Data form, let's see. Data pager. Yeah, here it is. So I have this submit button. So now let's give it a click event. Whoops. Yeah, there we go. So all I need to do is say dds.submitChanges. So that takes that. What that does is iterate through all the entities. Actually, we already know. We don't have to iterate on them. But get all the entities that are dirty, package them up, and send them to the server in one call. And then there's one more kind of thing we have to do. Because I've noticed a lot of times people want to hit submit changes while they're editing. So we have to do data form commit edit. So that is in case they're actually editing at the time. Okay, so now let's run it. And then let's go back to the server and go back up to these methods that we saw. Let's go to this update method. And I'm just going to set a breakpoint on update. And then let's go through and edit this guy. So Archie 3, Conan 3, Aquaman, Mr. Silverlight, Firestarter. Okay, so you can see we can make a couple of edits. We got three different guys that are dirty. So now if I click submit, what's going to happen is we got all those entities, we packaged them up, we sent them to the server. And then we did three things. First, we checked authorization. Is this person making the request able to make the request? In this case, they are, because we haven't turned on authorization yet. Then it does data validation. It says, is the data coming in conform correctly? If it's an int, is it type, is it? And then if I've done custom validation rules, which we'll talk about in a second, is that validation done? So authorization, validation, and then the last thing it does is it calls your update method. You say, okay, we've said, okay, it passes our test, you go update the database with it. And so what you get is you get an instance of current employee. And you see in the debugger here, where is name? It says Archie3, and that, whoops. Trust me, it says Archie3. You get that instance that we sent back from the server. The other thing you get, which is very cool, is we have changeset.getOriginal. So we within When the server sends back the ones that are updated, it also sends back their original values. So think about what you have to do here. A lot of times you have to do conflict resolution. So what you want to know is, what did the client think this value was? So you got three values, right? What did the client think it was? What did they change it to? And what is it now in the database? So what's it now in the database? You can go query the database and get that. What they think it is now is the argument there. And then what was it when they changed it? You can get that as well. So you can take all that data, and then we do some basic conflict resolution for you. And then if you would like to customize that, you can go ahead and in here you can handle the conflict resolution, look at the properties, and decide who wins in that case. Does that make sense? If the client crashes, that's on our list to do. We don't have that right now, a kind of a health monitoring kind of thing for the client. So no, we don't have that. But it's easy, it's reasonable to build that with what we have. That's one. Now notice we made three changes. That was one. And then if we run it again, now it's the second change we made. And now it's the third change we made. Now we should be done. So now we're done, and those updates come back. And notice what comes back is we don't just take whatever edit they made. We sent the update to the server, and the server sends back a new instance of that employee. So, for example, if there is some, you know, a timestamp number, or if they put in a value, and then on the server you have business logic that needs to change that value, we bring back the changed value back to the client. Does that make sense? Okay, so that's update. Now, the next thing I wanted to show you is validation. We looked at it a little bit before. Out of the box, for free, you get kind of what I would call type-level validation. So issues is int, and I typed a string in it, so I get an error there, which is nice. That's cool that you get that for free. But as somebody said earlier, what I'd really like to do is make this employee ID read-only, because they're not going to be able to change that key. I'd like to use a regular expression and set some ranges. So let's take a look at how we would go about doing that. So what do we need to do? Let's go back up to the server and go to this metadata class. So this is a class that the wizard created for us to give us a place to hang metadata on. So we can come in here. Whoops. We can come in here and set up a little bit of metadata. So for example, I can mark this guy read-only. So I don't know if anybody is familiar with ASP.NET Dynamic Data or ASP.NET MVC, but they honor exactly the same set of attributes. So it's the exact same model across. Say it again. Yes. So what I've done is I said this guy is read-only, and then I'll set another one to a regular expression. Let's see, I'll make this gender be a regular expression. And notice I've given it a little bit of a message here. And then I'll set the issues to be a range. So even though it's a nullable, I can go ahead and set it a range between 0 and 1,000. And then I can set something else to be required. Maybe we should set the name to be required. So now what I do, remember, I edited this on the server. Right? So now what I do is when I hit F5 here, hopefully this will work, then what I get now, the client knows about that data that I've just done. So for example, a couple of cool things here, just looking at the data form control. Notice employee ID read-only. That text box is really, you can't change it on the client. Gives you a nice, good user experience for that. Notice name is bold. So we went ahead and bolded it because that's required. Go ahead and communicate that to the user. The other thing we've done is if you go and ignore our UI hints, we do some nice data validation on that. So if I try to set this to -1, now it won't let me do that. What's nice for a big field, if it's a big form, is this helps you navigate this error summary, helps you navigate to the right one. And then if I got a little confused and typed the wrong thing there, then it gives me that hint. So that's very cool. But what's even, that's kind of a UI hint. What's even cooler is that in our, I mentioned before, in our pipeline, when this when I make a change and send it back up to the server, what the server does is it takes it apart, and one of the first things it does is looks at the data, and then it reruns all the validation rules. Because we don't know that you hit it from a Silverlight client, all right? Somebody could have hacked the thing and are just sending packets to your server. So we want to ensure that no matter what, all the validation gets run before your code gets a chance to execute. I think that's kind of cool. The other thing that I think is neat is what I showed you is what we call declarative validation. We also have custom validation. So in the interest of time, I can't show it to you. But essentially, you just write a .NET method. And it can either be one that runs only on the server, like in case it needs to access data or whatever, and you can do server-only validation, but you attach it to that property in exactly the same way. Or you can write a .NET method that will run on the server or the client. And we have a feature called shared code where you write the code once and we transfer it on the client and run it on the client for you as well. So that gives you the great UX experience there. So you could imagine like a credit card validation scheme is something more complex than you can do in a regex. So that's something you could write custom validation code for.
Are you going hungry?
Hold on just a second. Yeah. Yeah, that's a great one. So what the way we think of conditional validation is to model it as an entity validation. So this entity all up, like start date, end date, you know, is start date can't be, end date can't be before start date, or the one you mentioned. And so there's a way to do custom validation at the entity level. So you can do that scenario today. It's something we could make easier in the future, but yeah. Are we doing AJAX for validation? The ASP.NET MVC work takes these attributes and turns them into jQuery, uses the jQuery framework for it. We're not doing that here. This is all Silverlight. But the exact same attributes will work for ASP MVC as well. I don't know if that, did that answer it? Okay. Yes, so
you have fields on your server side, you can't two-way bind.
Yeah, yeah. So we're doing a little dance is what's happening. So what we do is this entity that you're bound against, the super employees entities, we co-gend that, and we co-gend it with properties. And we noticed if you had those custom attributes available on that class, we just pull them down and put them on the right place. At compile time. Yeah.
I saw the read-only attribute. Can it dynamically change it to read and write as a method?
Yeah, so that's a great general question. Can I dynamically change these? Not in Silverlight 3. So you can dynamically change the text box about whether it's in read-only mode or not. But in terms of the actual entity itself, there's not a way to do that in Silverlight 3. It is something we're looking at in the future. Okay. Geez, we're already out of time? Is that the issue?
Yeah, I think we're out of time.
Okay.
Yeah. Sorry.
Okay, yeah, great. Cool. All right, good. Well, thank you.
Thanks so much, Brad. Appreciate it. And if you have any questions, keep them. Brad, you'll be on the panel, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so Brad will be here on the panel starting 4:30 to 5 o'clock. So if you have any pressing questions, you can always ask him in the panel. So we'll take a quick 5-minute break because Carl needs a little more time, and we'll reconvene in 5 minutes, and we'll get started again. Thanks.